I guess we'll pretend to start, man, and I'll pretend to interview you, man. And
okay.
No, but I've been wanting to have you back on the show again, man. I'll just, you know, Rock Under Fire. We got Mike Nierenberg again, and I've been wanting to have you back on the show again because for a lot of reasons. But I was thinking the other day and remembering like the last time that you did this. We were like only a few weeks, like a few months into the podcast. And it was like our 10th episode, and I remember thinking, yeah, man, we made it this far. And, you know, so you're here for, this is the 58th episode.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, which isn't bad considering we're like bi-weekly, you know, and it's been like we've been largely, the whole process has been interrupted for the better part of the past year and a half because we really haven't recorded much at all in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm remembering how, like, several weeks after your episode, I remember looking at the charts, like the charts for the downloads and hits, and your show like skyrocketed our numbers. This was before we kind of had our set audience who listened regularly, you know.
That's
like
so
with each
strange
new episode, we roughly have the same number, you know. So I was like, what the fuck with Nierenberg, man? Like, what is going, like, you know, like, it didn't dawn on me that just maybe you had a bigger profile than me and Stick and Pat, you know, like, that people knew who you were, you know, and that you had a movie out. So I'm like, man, I'm like, and I even said to Pat, I think, man, what is this guy? Is he, like, he hacked into our system and is he, like, manipulating his own numbers? Or is like, I'm like, what the fuck with Nierenberg? So, yeah, so your show was like, but I wanted to tell you that, man. I just thought it was funny, man. And then
that's cool. I didn't know that. I don't remember what year that was. I might have had a little more heat on me than usual because of the movie at that time. But honestly, I mean, nothing I do really, you know, it's not that. It never is that big, like, which is cool. I'm not saying that. You know, it's just
what?
Like.
Anytime we have somebody big on, man, our numbers obviously are going to go up. So, I mean, that speaks a lot to, you know, I mean, it's good for you. It's good for us, too.
I want people to hear your show. I've been hearing your point of view for decades, you know. We've been friends a long time. And I love talking to people from the old country.
You know, you've got this book out. I guess our lead-in will be with you talking about that book.
Mm-hmm.
The July 28th release. So it was just released. It's Earth AD: The Poisoning of the American Landscape and the Communities That Fought Back. What is that? Is that Powerhouse, man?
Yeah, that was July 28th. It came out like we were talking about off microphone. That it was a strange time to put out a book about environmental disasters because the public was pretty fixated on the civil unrest and the virus, like it still is today. And it'll probably be that way for the foreseeable future. But environmental disasters still go on and they still are unaddressed. And there still are people working on them while the rest of the world goes on. So all these other problems that we had before the pandemic are still around. And, that's important to me. That actually interested me. Like, you know, when I realized I was going to be doing a book like this, an oral history about the environment, it's like everyone was talking about climate change, and climate change is probably the thing I think about the most. But I feel like it's well covered. And there's a lot of great books about pollution. But I wanted to do something closer to Please Kill Me about environmental disasters. Because I don't really feel like I'm a writer like you are, you know. I'm pretty good at, like, more documentary cutting interviews and scrapping them together, weaving them together into a narrative. It's funny. It's the only literary genre where you have to explain what it is. I've found a lot of the public at large, and even the reading public, is a lot of people are surprisingly unfamiliar with what oral history is. And it's pretty much documentary set the paper is
right.
The best way I would describe it.
You talked about the collage aspects of threading together oral history. I mean, that in itself is an art form. So, I mean, I'm drawing from your book release discussion from a few weeks back. The journalistic aspects of subject areas that, like you said, have great articles written on them, but don't have anything extensive in the form of book publications. So it's like you said, you've seen it in music, but nothing serious. You know,
yeah.
And I thought
yeah.
about that, and you're right. I can't think of anything offhand in any real, you know, really serious subject that's done from the point of from oral history.
They're starting to happen now, but it's very slow. And strangely, it's I think it's probably catching on more now, because now that I've done one, I'm more sensitive to receiving them, like seeing that they're around, you know, in book reviews and places like Voices from Chernobyl. I read, I think, somewhere after the halfway point of doing my book. And that was different because it's still considered an oral history, but every chapter is broken up by a single person's story who lived through it, you know. But we still call it oral history. Where what I did was close to, I was really inspired by Gene Stein and George Clinton, what they did with the RFK book. I forgot what the proper title of that one is, the Edie one. And she only did 3 books in her lifetime. And the last one she put out a few years ago before she jumped out a window in Manhattan was about the super rich families of Los Angeles. But I was super into Gene Stein, and that's when I realized I had read Gene Stein's last book, and I was like, that's what I want to do. Getting a movie made getting another documentary made is such a fucking hassle, you know? It's like so much money and so many people. It's like I could just do it on paper.
Right.
You know, with just my laptop, and I work on TV, so I usually, you know, we shoot so much, and they need me so little. Some on-set artist, they need me to like handwrite a letter or something like that, or you know, spatter some blood against the ceiling, and then I'm back to my laptop. I can write a book. That's one of the perks. But I digress. I'm going off on a tangent.
Nah, man, we're all about tangents. I mean, to keep it in terms of the origins of the whole project, your thing sort of began with a guy named Jeff Cobb, whose book was kind of like a springboard for something that you really got into the details of. He was kind of fixture in that neighborhood, like who?
Oh yeah, and this is something I started to address in the book release panel, but to go deeper in there, Jeff Cobb. So my son was in first grade at the time, and we lived in Greenpoint, and he brought home this, like, you know, like, it's like a folder, and the parents have to go through it and, like, look through, make sure you did your homework and all that stuff. And there was a talk on the environment. It was like, bring the kids. And I knew Greenpoint had this crazy environmental history. I knew a lot of the residential houses were on top of an oil spill. But it was hazy, you know. I heard little bits on NPR. I heard people casually mention it in conversations, but it was never made clear to me how extensive the pollution was. I went to this talk, and it was at the local high school, and Jeff Cobb was giving it. But all the children, they just are running around playing, and all the adults were fixated on what Jeff was saying. They were like, we were all hanging on every word. And then someone in the back said, my grandparents both came down with the same rare kind of leukemia. And I was like, holy shit. And it was because they both lived in the same house. And then that's when I was like, so I bought Jeff's books, took them home, read about them, sort of forgot about them. And then this came around a few years later. That was probably about 2014 or 15. I read the book then. And then 2018, I started talking with Farrell about doing a book. And at that point, I kind of started to put together. At first, it was going to be 3 sites. I wanted to do a site about the Midwest. It was originally, because there's so many you could choose from, you know. So I started asking people, like, what is, like, the most egregious environmental disasters that you think more people should know about? So I started soliciting ideas, and that's where I heard about Tar Creek through Mark Yagi at the Waterkeeper Alliance, who's become a friend of mine. And they've been working with them. They supply attorneys. They've spun out a Riverkeeper, and they supply legal assistance to people who are defending the Clean Water Act. So yeah, then eventually, about 6 months into doing Tar Creek in Oklahoma, I couldn't do a third site. I knew the second site was going to be the one in Brooklyn because I lived on top of it. Then I just, it was still going to be three sites when I was doing, but Tar Creek took so long because it is so crazy and there is so much to discuss. You have, so in short, that's a site that during the early 1900s, late 1800s, there was oil discovered there. And so after they discovered oil there, they eventually discovered lead, at which point they started drilling and then became a boom town. And then after it became a boom town, little by little, industry left. And then after industry left, people still lived there. Then they started noticing in the 80s that people, that their performance of school children, it was also Native American land. A lot of it was Native American land that was bought by the mining companies. And when the mining companies had left, a lot of people still lived there. A lot of Native children lived there. And they were all lead poisoned. There's mountain ranges of mining waste everywhere. And then the town started sinking. And so, like houses were falling into the mines underneath the... I mean, it's just fucking insane. And I got so into this story. And then, yeah, I could just go off about it. Then there was, like, then they eventually bought the town out. But I got really interested in, like, a super poor place like that. And then you have a super rich place, like in Greenpoint, where I used to live, where per capita income... is the average income is in the six figures. So you have extremely poor rural people. How is Superfund treated in a red state versus a blue state? How are Superfunds treated? Are they being bought out by the government because no one could live there, or do they gentrify on top of them, like here?
Right. Newtown Creek was pretty much, it wasn't always like that, though, right? It was coming from a kind of an industrialized working class area up until maybe, what, the 90s? Is that
right? And then, yeah, about the 90s, you know, what usually happens here and I think in other cities is that artists come in first because of the cheap, like, industry leaves. You know, we saw this in places like Detroit. Industry leaves. They leave big industrial buildings behind, warehouses. You know, I was a young artist. I lived in neighborhoods like that. And then after industry, the artists come in. And then after that, real estate speculators come in. You know, it takes the artist to make that area trendy. And then after the area is trendy, people start moving in and real money comes in. They develop it. But what was happening in Greenpoint is people were developing these you know, mega condos. And they were digging into the ground, and they found chemical spills. Like there's a dry cleaning plant that put something like 40,000 gallons of phthalates, which are used to make plastic soft, which is used in all kinds of things. Underneath a playground, but the big one was the oil spills from Exxon, or Standard Oil, which became Exxon. So there was spill on top of spill. So you had all kinds of, like, cancerous materials. You also had the city putting in several garbage transfer stations, so there are always garbage trucks rolling through. So it was pretty – it was like a Polish working-class neighborhood, and it still is to some degree. But now it's like luxury condos. But it still has all this pollution underneath that people just generally don't think about. And then there's – Newtown Creek is a body of water – that's 4 miles that separates Brooklyn from Queens that has 150 years of dumping. I mean, we're talking epic dumping. Like, there was copper plants and paint plants and, you know, until oil refinery took everything over. And there was, like, meat rendering plants where, like, you know, like people dump like bones in there and all kinds of shit. And this went on for like 100 years until it just, until the Clean Water Act, and then things stopped for a while. And then they found the oil turned up under the, under Greenpoint. And that's when people started getting sick and falling out.
Greenpoint in one of several neighborhoods reading about in, I guess, the late 90s, that made Brooklyn the quote unquote best kept secret in New York City at the time.
And,
you know, if you were planning on living in New York, and you know, the people that wanted to live in Manhattan but couldn't afford it, so people are, you know, dude, it's Brooklyn. Go to, you know, and people are going to Brooklyn now. And I remember, I think Greenpoint was one of those neighborhoods.
Absolutely, and I lived there for 8 years, something like that. And I don't live there now. I still live in Brooklyn, but I don't live there now. I don't think I could have done this book if I still lived there.
But
I want
to ask you, in terms of the laws, you know, that you had mentioned, Tar Creek, right? Tar Creek,
mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And Newtown Creek, they're known as Superfund sites, and that's basically in reference to a law that was passed in like the early 80s.
Yeah, Superfund, CERCLA, the law.
Okay, so CERCLA, yeah. So when this law is put in place, right, and it basically allows the EPA to clean up sites that are contaminated. But what I wanted to ask you about, like you had mentioned Exxon, you know, because this law also is Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, 1980, okay, I just read that, which basically makes polluters responsible. So does this mean that prior to the law, it would have been harder to make Exxon responsible for shit like oil spills that happened near the end of the 80s, like Exxon?
Well, the oil spill was discovered in 1978 by the Coast Guard, I think. Something like that. It was discovered in 1978. Although the community had known about it for years, and there was an activism in the community, and at times the rest of the media would find out about it, and it would just be like a blip. But then a group of young attorneys who were working at Riverkeeper got kind of curious about that body of water that they could. So Basil Segos, who is now the director, the commissioner of environmental conservation, the DEC, he's the commissioner over there now. But when he was a young attorney, he was with Riverkeeper, and they sailed into there, and they were like, holy shit, this place is so fucked up. Like, you would see like just oil covering the entire surface. And since then, I've went on Riverkeeper's boat, and they brought me around there. And it is a fairly substantial amount of water. I mean, it's 4 miles that separate two populous boroughs in you know, one of the most populated cities in the country. So anyway, so he got to work. He started learning all he could about it, and he started putting the screws to Exxon. And then what happened was Elliot Spitzer, I think, started some litigation, and then it was finished by Andrew Cuomo. And Andrew Cuomo, who was an ambitious attorney general at the time, he was the one who brought Exxon to the table to negotiate, because Exxon had taken on all the liabilities of Standard Oil, and that dumping was from Standard Oil. So to be clear, that dumping was a combination of dumping chemicals like kerosene and things into the water, but it was also had to do with these fires. There was a fire in, I think, 1918. There was another one in 1887. I could be mistaken about those dates. But there were these fires that would catch entire oil tankers on fire, you know, and it would spread and catch other oil tankers on fire. And these oil tankers would just burn down and blow up. And they would also leak, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons, millions of gallons, who knows how many gallons. So it's theorized that these leaks came from those fires. Because what was happening in the after Riverkeeper discovered it in the 70s, people were smelling gas in their basements. People were smelling oil in their basements, and there were high cancer rates in the area. And people were getting sick. People would get these headaches. things. It was a very Toxic Avenger type scene. In fact, I think Lloyd Kaufman shot Toxic Avenger over there, which is a little bit of my old career.
We see a lot of environmental legislation overturned in the previous administration, in the current administration, but have Superfund sites been threatened by, say, Republican legislation over the years, or even currently? Like, has the current administration tried to weaken, or even try to like eliminate the law?
We've had some weak Democrats and strong Republicans in that area too. I mean, nowadays we don't. Now the Republican Party is openly hostile to the environmental movement. I can't speak for, like, I think people like the Lincoln Project and people like that probably have a lot of, you know, sensible Republicans who take it seriously. But generally, and I go to great pains to explain this in the book, because I don't want to paint one party responsible when both parties are. But there's now, I don't know what the current state is, but the current administration is openly hostile to Superfund, and they've not mandated the EPA to, I mean, this is Scott Pruitt, the EPA, you know, oil lobbyist, and the guy who's in there now was also some kind of lobbyist. And there, a lot of these things are going to court, like places like attorneys like Waterkeeper taking a lot of these companies to a lot of these they're taking the EPA to court and saying you are mandated to clean this up and collect the money from these corporations, these they're called PRPs, potentially responsible parties, to clean up the to clean up and to bring money in to be awarded to people who suffered damages. So it is
CERCLA, pretty much.
That's because of CERCLA, right. To my understanding, they would need a majority of senators to repeal CERCLA. But you get like something like Tar Creek. Inhofe refused to do anything. You had a Republican governor there who was like, how could this be in our state? How could we have people this poor who are dying of, how can we have a whole generation of kids the same age being poisoned by lead in this country? And he put together a strong commission. And he had, and at the time, there was a Democrat congressman, Brad Carson, and interviewed both those guys. And both of those guys worked across party lines to try to solve it. They were stopped by Inhofe at every turn. That dude, he's so corrupt. I mean, this is a guy who just took oil money wherever he could and wouldn't do anything. Until I think he just became politically untenable, because what happened was Tar Creek became a national media story once the town started sinking into the mines. So you throughout the history of these sites, there's been very strong politicians and very weak politicians. But CERCLA was a big deal when it happened in the 80s, because all of a sudden it put corporations on the hook for what they were dumping.
Right,
into
right.
people's communities. Now, Greenpoint's a little different, because Greenpoint came up around these factories. There was all this industry along the creek, and every single industry, I can't stress that sort of pollution enough. They were all dumping in there at the same time. So these communities, it was before zoning laws, so they just sprouted up around the factories. And that sort of is how it founded. Same thing with Tar Creek. There is no zoning laws then. So they had communities coming up around the lead mining. People just went to work. It was a boom town, and both those communities have in common is that they came up through the Industrial Revolution. And at the time, to be fair, most people didn't think about the environment. They were mining the lead in Tar Creek. The amount of lead that they had in those mines, they supplied, I think, nearly half of all the Allies' bullets in World War II. You know, came out of those mines. They saw themselves, and they were heroes. We were winning the war. We were beating the Nazis. It was a good project. And over time, as responsibility shifted, priorities shifted, and it was getting harder and harder to get people to take it seriously.
Sounds like, man, it's a fucking daunting task that you've, again, being inspired by Cobb's book, man, and just taking it and bringing something a lot further to the table in terms of furthering public knowledge of these places, man. Mike Nirenberg, Earth AD, the book is Earth AD, The Poisoning of the American Landscape and the Communities That Fought Back. Where can people buy this book?
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
Available anywhere. I don't know if all
stores have it. You're like me, man. You don't like to plug things, man. You don't want to, like, plug yourself, man. It's all right. It's on Amazon. It's everywhere.
You know. But it's true. It is pretty much everywhere. Everywhere online, that is.
Yeah.
We the publisher and myself, we usually push people towards to use bookshop.org because it's a more equitable model towards supporting independent bookstores and small locally owned book chains.
Mm-hmm.
But if you prefer shopping at Amazon, it's there too. It's everywhere. I mean, that's one good thing. The distributor got it to all of the online markets. Support independent publishing.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. On that one, man.
It's good for you.
You were recently asked to select an environmentally themed playlist. Can I ask what's on that list, man? Or is that, I mean, when you told
oh,
me,
well, it was
man,
a
you
very...
know that my first thoughts were going to be like REM's Life's Rich Pageant in Green.
No, actually what happened was I was asked to do this playlist for Large Hearted Boy, which comes out. It's this book industry blog, and they have a section of the blog where they ask authors to make a playlist based on the book. And so I thought it would be – I spent a lot of time thinking about this before I did anything. I just started sketching out ideas because music is my only real hobby, you know. Mm-hmm. And I listened to music the entire time. So I interpret it as the music I listened to. There was the music that inspired the book that I was listening to and real hot on. And then
okay.
The second half and then what I'm calling side two was the stuff I listened to while I actually wrote the book. Because I think there is not a robust genre of environmental music that I think is particularly good. Yeah, there's some of it, like the REM you mentioned is great. And
so Corey Hope is not on that list?
No. I named
that was the first thing I thought of, man.
I came up with the name of the book. I went to the Misfits reunion in Jersey, and they were my favorite band when I was a kid. They were like Kiss to me, like the way Kiss is for you.
Right.
The Misfits were to me. And so I was so hyped, and I smoked like 1,000 vape pen hits and drank a bunch of vodka seltzers. And I was like, and I was pretty fucked up, and I was getting a ride home, and I was like, I'm going to call the book Earth AD after the Misfits song. Mm-hmm. It was just like clicked. I had just started the book. I knew what the title was before I even like put anything down. Which is funny to think about now. Like, I knew what it was going to be called. And so that's on there. And so there was, like, stuff I was listening to, and it ranges from contemporary hip-hop and punk and it's really all over the place. And the second part is mostly jazz, because I mostly listen to jazz while I work, because I can't listen to anything with words. So I picked some of the jazz records that I was really hot on at the time. A lot of stuff by like Anthony Braxton.
Does jazz make you crazy though? A little bit too if the jazz is a little bit too chaotic, man, do you have to even turn that stuff down or off?
No,
or
I love that shit.
So I can't
write
that
shit.
Stuff down.
It somehow the more crazy jazz gets, the more creative it makes me. The more like on edge it makes me, the better. I love that kind of thing. Like, I got super into guys like I said, Anthony Braxton. But then I would need to, like, cool down with Charlie Parker or something that sounds good, you know, that would be, like, melodic. So I wouldn't like it a lot. But then I would listen to very, like, atonal, like, noise music. And just, like, when I'm working with words, I can't listen to hip-hop, which is mostly what I listen to. So it was, like, you know, it was just one of those things where, like, I might have been listening to a lot of hip hop when I wasn't writing and a lot of punk, but I can't listen to anything like that. I would listen to some just empty beats. Like, I would listen to like instrumentals by people like Pete Rock and DJ Premier and stuff like that. But
anything with words, man, you know, it's like you might as well have like two or three people talking over your shoulder while you're trying to write. You know,
absolutely. It gums up the words.
Having a conversation in the room. You know, it's just
it's hard for me to even write an email like with with words playing. I'm too sensitive to music.
Yeah, man.
You know?
But, I mean, on the subject of music, man, and the whole environmental thing, man, and, you know, I mean, I mentioned REM in Cuyahoga. Did REM get out just in time, man, by breaking up? You know, like I write about this a lot, man. We're living in an age where artists were once looked to, man, for answers, or at the very least, like a reflection of all the turmoil and bullshit in any particular period of time. You know, they're hailed as spokespeople of their generations, et cetera, et cetera. And now they've gone from that to shut up and sing. You know,
I don't think that's entirely true.
You know?
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. I think the difference is people are still expressing themselves through music, through songs. Like I said, I don't think there's a whole robust genre of environmentally themed music. I think there's an opportunity for pop music to come up with more enthusiasm for climate change, voting rights. But you see that happening more. You see guys like Jay-Z out there, like, you know, getting in front of these issues. I think the difference now is when we were growing up, there was no internet, and the chorus of voices denouncing someone for speaking their mind is louder. But they were still there. They just know, like, you know, you know, the guy across the street, he might have just been like some like cranky Republican or whatever, but like he wasn't online. There was nowhere for him to express his views except yelling across the street. But no one cared. Now he can kind of amass a little bit of a following of other morons. There was, you know, like, you know, there wasn't a Fox News. There wasn't like all these outlets for people to say things. Now people just say shit all the time.
People,
it's like, have their own musicians.
Personal
yeah,
forms,
like
social media and Facebook and
right,
Twitter,
right,
and
they,
like that, things like that.
Yeah, so I think that's really the difference. Artists are still out there saying shit. I think, like, even someone like Cardi B, I don't particularly listen to Cardi B, but I think, actually, I do think she's not cute, but so on. But that aside, she's out there starting trouble, you know? She's out there, like, speaking her mind, and people are telling her to shut up. And she's like,
yeah, she's speaking her mind, man. But, you know, it's like you said, I think, a lot of it, to a very large degree, is the 24-hour cable news cycle, where, you know, where somebody speaking their mind, using their platform, is met within 24 hours with a massive backlash, and then they're calling for boycotts, and then the death threats begin. I mean, I don't think artists were going through, I don't think Jackson Brown was going through that, you know, by any media outlet, you know, with the No Nukes movement, you know. It's a much different monster now, man. Like, artists are just, I mean, artists, are, you know, rock stars have become lumped in with Hollywood, and it's just like one big pot of, you know, if you're a liberal man, you're defined as that. You're defined as this, like, low-life, anti-American scum, you know, if you support a Democrat or something.
It speaks,
you know,
to the success of outlets like Fox News and The Daily Caller and the Tucker Carlson of the world. I mean, I don't even watch that shit, but I get a sense of what they're saying by the way people react to it.
Yeah.
I think that speaks to that success. Jackson Brown didn't have to contend with those things. I think that's really the only difference. And I think, you know, you get a guy like Kendrick Lamar, and he's kind of taken on, like, you know, something of a Bob Dylan-ish role, where young people are listening to him, and he's rhyming about racism and the problems of today. Or J. Cole's another one who I think is really great and, like, doing the same kind of work. I think it's just, you know, it just shifts. It's like, to me, it's no different than what's going on, you know, or the times they are changing, you know. It's just,
yeah,
a different time, and the artists are different, and they're responding to it differently because they're using their own albums. It's an ideological war.
Just speaking more to my idea that it's just the cultural zeitgeist has shifted, man, and just the socially active, relevant artists are rappers as opposed to rock stars now? You know, has rock just gotten that conservative where, you know, a lot of we went through metal in the 80s, you know, and it just seems that, you know, I don't know one liberal metalhead, man. You know, it's fucking crazy, man. It's just like metal makes people conservative, man.
Really interesting. It's like, I saw a meme, you know, and one half was like a bunch of punks flipping off a cop, and the other side had like a bunch of like drill sergeants, and it said, punk is not this, it is that, you know, meaning that being an alt-right asshole isn't punk. Punk meant like being yourself.
Yeah,
know?
I don't
being
buy
like,
it. Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of that, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but rock is kind of like while great rock music is still coming out, and I think it's still an important medium, it is no longer the dominant medium of society, for better or worse.
Yeah.
I don't feel one way or the other about it.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that, you know, like when Kent State happened, you know, you had Neil Young writing Ohio, and it became a top 20 song, you know, and Edwin Starr's War was a number one song that same summer, and Lennon had a huge hit with Power to the People the same summer, you know. Can you, like...
No, I
like
can't.
Humanitarian crises like Bangladesh and Kampuchea and Ethiopia without the platforms of rock stars even reaching Western awareness in the suburbs of New Jersey, you know?
Right.
You know, unless you read the New York Times or something. Like, I mean, the only reason we knew as teenagers in the suburbs who Nelson Mandela was because of people like Bono and Human Rights Now and Amnesty International, who's, you know, like profile was given this massive worldwide recognition through rock stars, you know, and that is an era that I think is largely past. And if there's anybody that's assuming that role,
I think there's a little more
over into rap now, man. Is it, you know, are the rap stars really the new rock stars?
I would think so. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
There probably is rock music that I don't listen to that people listen to, politically. That's politically active. But I think rock music, when we were younger and the generation before mine, yours, and further back, was like, it was a dominant youth culture, right? Like it was designed for kids, and kids became activists because of the times and because of the music, and it was just like a perfect storm for that. But then rock music and music in general has fragmented into niche categories for all kinds of people. So like, If you were a teenager and like I was a teenager in the 90s, and I think a lot of people my age stopped listening to music in the 90s, and so they still think of rock music as like Nirvana or whatever. And that's fine, but I think there's always going to be young people listening to something else, and I think that's good. And I just think the dominant art form isn't so dominant. I mean, there might be a singles chart still, as far as I know, but I don't know what's on it because I'm a guy in my 40s.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, you know.
I don't even know what the fucking metrics are anymore, man, for measuring what is a hit and what is, you know, not. You know?
Right. And actually, I hope the way I'd like to see this play out is I'd like to see kids come up with some shit that I can't relate to. Like, most pop music sounds like a McDonald's commercial to me. I want the kids to make something so weird I can't relate to, and it hasn't happened yet. I guess it's part of my problem is, like, I haven't been shocked yet, you know? Like, nothing has made me feel reactionary more than, like, commercialization as much as, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's, like, so much stuff just sounds like it's selling French fries and shit, you know? It's, like, and, you know, it's funny. It's, like, hip-hop, in a way, is split off into two different camps, too. It's, like, so much of it is, like, pop, right? And then the other half is quite conservative. Like the older sort of people who grew up listening to hip hop, I'm probably in that camp too. Like I live in Brooklyn, and you can't go, I'd say, 2 days without hearing Biggie Smalls either coming out of someone's car or in a bodega or coming from one of the surrounding yards over here. And I think to myself, I've heard Biggie Smalls is like the Led Zeppelin of hip hop. I can't fucking listen to it anymore. It's like has no magic left for me. And I think that there's a conservatism there, which was that speaks to the rock conservatism inside heavy metal of a certain year. I mean, I imagine that there's still, I've gone to St. Vitus and a few clubs here, and there would be metal shows. Some of them are quite good, but it doesn't hold the zeitgeist.
Speaking to that, in terms of, you know, what this is and what this isn't regarding the punks, it just drives home what I think about the, you know, again, if you went through metal in the 80s, and I still love a lot of it, you know.
Yeah, me too.
I love a lot of it. I still listen to Priest. Maiden, and a lot of that stuff, man.
Absolutely. I think at least once a week, I think to myself, God damn, I could go for some Scorpions.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Fuck, I'm going to break out. Like, you know, like I said earlier in this conversation, that, like, collecting records has been, like, my sort of middle-aged man hobby, you know. And, like, I find myself, like, late at night on eBay being, like, I mean, before the pandemic, I slowed down considerably, but before the pandemic, I'd be, you know, not writing the book. I'd be, like, fucking around on the internet. I'd be like, oh, man, put a bid down for the first two Megadeth records, you know, and kind of eyeball that. And then, oh, I got some Miles Davis records over here coming in. I'm eyeballing that auction, you know. It's, like, my taste are really ranged out, you know. Like, I spend about every day, and I think you know this about me, I listen to on average 5 new records, and new to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
like this morning I was listening to Mark Stewart's solo records from the pop group. Like, I don't know those records, but I came across them reading Tricky's autobiography before bed. There's just so many different little niche areas I just don't know about, so I'm always poking my nose into those places. Because I'm endlessly curious about it. It never died in me. I think a lot of my friends, as they get older, stopped exploring things. And I don't even care if I like it. I'm just trying
what,
to
what I find is that, you know, the attitude of, like, just the, I don't know, the over, just the temperament of the average metalhead in the 80s. I don't know if it was ever part of my mindset. You know, like, if you were a metal fan in the 80s and your friends were metalheads in the 80s, it's like, it's more than likely that you felt more pressured than at home in your supposed metalhead alienation from whatever the fuck accepted society was, you know. And
I mean that
you wore a uniform, man. You know, there was a code, there was a metal language. You know, you used phrases like false metal, and you used words like poser. And if you dared get caught listening
poser
to something like U2 or REM, man, or like if you admitted that you liked Bruce Springsteen, man, it meant that you were either gay or you weren't a real metalhead, you know. You know, you had to look a certain way, you had to act a certain way. It was just as phony and calculated as the punks were, you know. And if we have to talk posers, I mean, I don't think that there's the two biggest groups of them were the punks and the metalheads, because it was all based on appearances, man. You know, people trying to dictate what was real and what wasn't real, and people getting caught up in a definition of themselves. And I think for a lot of those people, they carried that with them into adulthood, and they're in their 50s now, and they're still all fucked up over it, you know?
It's so weird.
I see, like, a lot of people, like, just on Facebook alone, for example, man, they'll post a song, and they'll be like, you know, they'll post a song from something like the Bee Gees, or like, who can I say here, man? Okay, like REO Speedwagon or John Denver or Olivia Newton-John, and they'll post it, and they'll feel the need to explain themselves as if they're, like, apologizing for it. Well,
right.
I don't believe to convince their friends, their metalhead friends, in their own little veiled way that this song isn't so bad, you know?
Oh, man, it's so weird.
There's, like, a guilt that comes with metalheads, man, that, like, comes from having this lifelong image of yourself. Like, who you think people think you are. You
absolutely.
Know?
It's weird. And there's a self-identity that's formed in your teenage years that you usually can outgrow. But for some reason, you said it perfectly. It's like there's a conservatism, there's a reactionism. It's very conservative in that, like, when I was growing up, I was, like, really confused because I was, like, a huge metalhead in the 80s, but I was, like, a little kid, you know? And like stuff of like REM would come out or the Pixies, and I was like, I really like this, but is it metal enough? Am I like, you know? And I was telling my wife this recently that like how funny that is to me now. Like, I think now the most punk thing you could do is like go work on Wall Street or something. Like, I think like when I see someone with like spiked like a mohawk, I mean, I think good for you, you're doing your own thing, but you know it's been done. Like, I just think that, you know, I think what's signaled is that you're in a club, and it goes against the whole ethos of it. Like, I love the quote from the Minutemen. I think it was Mike Watt who said, oh, we thought punk meant doing whatever you wanted. We wore, like, flannel shirts because we really like Creedence Clearwater Revival. And to me, that's what punk is about. And I mean punk in the broadest sense, like metal and hip-hop and, like, early hip-hop. Was like that. It was like punk in spirit. It was like very like we're doing our own thing. Fuck with the music industry things. And I still really respect that position. But there's unfortunately it's really tied up in people's self identity, and it's a very boring place to be, and it's not dynamic.
It's like, you know, you hear like a lot of metalheads talk about guilty pleasures.
And I don't believe in that.
I don't believe in it either, man, because, you know, it's like a guilty pleasure is this, like, it's like this easy way out where we could admit to liking something without having to take shit for it, you know? And I don't buy that, you know? I have no guilty pleasures because I have no guilt with music, man. If I like it, it's good, you know? And
I'm
don't care.
I'm an American artist. I got no guilt.
I don't care if it's Barry Manilow or if it's the fucking Velvet Underground. If I like it, it's cool, you know?
Yeah, I read Twitter takes, but I'm not that online, you know. I guess I'm just not plugged into a lot of people who are – I think I cut a lot of non-dynamic people out. I think if some people are just, like, not keeping up, I'm good. Like, I just don't care, you know. Like, I'm just living my life and trying to – and being interested in the things I'm interested in. Like, it's funny because I've seen on my wife that, like – I like to cook every night for my family, and I sit there and I've been watching The Office while I cook, and I was like, I didn't watch this while it was on, you know, I didn't watch any TV when this was on, you know, and I love it, and I think, you know, it's more punk. I love this show. It's very punk of me because it would be really unpunk to love this show, and that she's like, at what point are you just regular?
People and don't expect like, you to watch it. So that's why it's punk to you, man.
It's right. It's like the punks wouldn't expect me to be so, like, regular, you know? Like, and I love that, you know? I think that's my reaction to it. It's like, I really take that to heart. I think that, like, being true to who you are, you don't... I guess it's just something I outgrew so long ago that, like, it's, like, funny to me now, you know?
We've been at this for, like, what? An hour and 20 minutes, I'll probably cut the first...
That's good.
The first 20 minutes, man. Yeah.
We got all kinds of takes. Is there any closing bit we do where or you just cut it off somewhere?
I'm gonna cut it off somewhere, man.
Bad news, but only if you wanna be. You can